Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, Governor J.B. Pritzker talks about COVID-19 and how being in his position during this time has affected him. Remote teaching is harder for some college classes than others. We'll hear about what it means for broadcasting students. The coronavirus has changed what's allowed when someone dies. Funerals are being scaled down, and in some cases, services postponed.
Decisions have been made, and policies, if you will, that have been implemented has been made on behalf of those, the living, for their safety.
Being out in the farm fields might seem like one of the best ways to do social distancing, but the current situation is creating challenges for those in agriculture. We'll hear from one farmer. And a renowned singer-songwriter from Illinois has died from COVID-19. We'll look back on the life and career of John Prine. That and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll hear from a state lawmaker who has another job, funeral director, and both positions are being impacted by the coronavirus. We'll also hear from Governor J.B. Pritzker as he leads the state during the pandemic. First up this week, we remember the folk artist John Prine, whose lyrics were startling in their empathy and their beauty. He was born in Maywood, Illinois, and discovered in Chicago's folk music scene back in 1970. He died this month at the age of 73. Carrie Shepherd looks back at the career of one of America's great songwriters.
In October 1970, the late great critic Roger Ebert wrote this in the Chicago Sun-Times. He sings rather quietly, and his guitar work is good, but he doesn't show off. He starts slow, but after a song or two, even the drunks in the room begin to listen to his lyrics. And then he has you.
But the morphine eased the pain, and the grass grew around his brain.
It seems only fitting that a writer of Ebert's eloquent and egalitarian style would be drawn into John Prine's lyrics when Prine was singing at the club Fifth Peg in 1970. Prine grew up in the western suburbs of Maywood and Melrose Park. When Ebert saw him, Prine was performing songs he had written while working his route as a mailman in the suburbs. Prine told WBEZ's Sound Opinions in 2018, it was a great job for a songwriter.
You had all this time on your hands to think about stuff. It was a perfect, I need to be doing something else when I'm writing.
Ed Holstein was on the folk scene with Prine back then. Holstein is a musician and songwriter who teaches at Chicago's Old Town School of Folk Music. He says Prine knew how to play the audience, tell stories, make connections, tap into his blue-collar roots.
The plumber, we'd be talking and they'd say, the music's okay, but I'll tell you who I like. I like that John Prine guy. And John, I told John that, and he said, yeah, I know, pest control people like me, too.
Artist Harry Waller came to Chicago in 1974 and hung out with Prine in the music clubs along Lincoln Avenue. Waller says with Prine, there was no pretense.
He was like his music. I mean, he was really, that was John Prine. I mean, he was that guy that you saw on stage.
Waller performed with Prine on a Grammy-winning tribute album to folk legend Steve Goodman. Prine's solo work won 2 Grammys, and he was one of this year's Lifetime Achievement honorees. Waller remembers Prine as an upbeat guy whose lyrics could be goofy, something Prine talked about on Sound Opinions in 2018.
I really try and avoid in my lyrics being super, super serious because I'm writing about things that are heavy to me. I wouldn't ever say they're heavy to somebody else. That's for them to decide.
She don't like her eggs all running. She thinks that crossing her legs is funny. She looks down her nose at money. She gets it on like the Easter Bunny. She's my baby. I'm her.
But it was the darkness and realness of Prine's lyrics that resonate with so many.
I'd like to stay, but I might have to go. Start over again. I might go back down to Texas or go to somewhere that I've never been.
Here's then U.S. Poet Laureate Ted Kooser introducing Prine at the Library of Congress in 2005.
I bought John Prine's first album on LP at 33 when it was released, played it as soon as I got home, and knew at once that here was a truly original writer, unequaled, and a genuine poet of the American people.
Prine has lived with wife Fiona Whalen Prine in Nashville for many years. That's where he died from complications due to COVID-19, according to his family.
When I get to heaven, I'm going to shake God's hand, thank him for more blessings than one man can stand. Then I'm going to get a guitar and start a rock and roll band.
John Prine was 73 years old. Carrie Shepherd, WBEZ News.
And then I'm going to get a cocktail, vodka and ginger ale. Yeah, I'm going to smoke a cigarette that's 9 miles.
Illinois college professors are now teaching students online, but that transition from in-person to digital learning is more challenging for some classes than for others, as Lee Gaines with Illinois Newsroom brings us this report.
Students at the University of Illinois produce a weekly live TV show called Good Morning Illini, or GMI for short. It's kind of like a student version of the Today Show.
Good morning, Illini, and welcome to the show. I'm Patch Gazlin.
And I'm Becca Wood. Patrick, how are you doing this lovely Friday morning?
Good.
Students work on the show all week. They have a studio and students take turns hosting. That changed in mid-March. The University of Illinois and many other colleges across the country suspended in-person instruction to contain the spread of COVID-19. Classes moved online. Students working on Good Morning Illini made one last show before spring break, mostly about coronavirus.
Today is going to be the last episode of GMI for this season, unfortunately.
The students signed off at the end of the video as a group on camera. Some wiped tears from their eyes. Kenya Williams, a junior, was among them.
Thought like, wow, I'm finally being part of GMI, like, for real, and now it's being snatched away from me because of this virus.
Professor Ken Erdy supervises the production of Good Morning Illini, and he was devastated too.
I didn't see a potential of how do I teach a live studio broadcast class in an online format.
Erdy's classes are based in the TV studio on campus. Guests come into the studio and students operate the cameras. Erdy says the focus is on hands-on learning. But the pandemic made that impossible. Erdy found inspiration online.
And this video popped up on my feed at some point that said it was from the Italians when they were 10 days into their quarantine. And it's just people telling their stories to themselves. And I was like, you know, maybe I can do something with that.
So Erdy built a website and asked his students to film video diaries or vlogs while sheltering in place. That's what Kenya Williams, the U of I junior, is doing now from her apartment in Champaign.
So first thing, I don't have a computer. And as we all know, UIUC students, we all have, and other people too as well, we have to take online classes.
Williams is from Chicago, but she's currently living and working in Champaign. She doesn't have a way to edit and post videos online. So Williams sent her vlog to Connor Seco. He's also a junior at the university and a producer on the Good Morning Illini show.
We are in such an incredibly unique situation. Good Morning Illini is so rooted in being on the ground, covering the campus, and just being in that studio. We have had to completely rework this.
Seco is also making his own vlogs from his parents' house in Western Springs, a suburb of Chicago. He hopes that at the end of the semester, there will be a lot of videos on the website showcasing his and his peers' talents under challenging circumstances.
That we can look back on and we can track the progression of the pandemic and say, we covered that. We weren't physically there for that, but we were still on top of that.
Erdy, the professor, says he's told his students how important it is to document their own stories during this historic time. He gets a little choked up when he talks about it.
They had done nothing but step up to that and present content that does everything I asked them to do and more. And that's pretty amazing.
Erdy thinks this experience will ultimately help his students get jobs in news media. But he also can't wait to see them again. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
For over 40 straight days now, Governor J.B. Pritzker has given the state a daily update on COVID-19. The first-term Democratic governor is trying to beat a life-and-death crisis for which there's no playbook. Pritzker talked with WBEZ reporter Dave McKinney about how he's managing the crisis and its emotional toll, and even how Tiger King is helping him get through it.
For all the ways the pandemic has upended almost every aspect of life in Illinois, it's this alarmingly simple question that Governor J.B. Pritzker now has a hard time answering. What day is it?
You know, there's no end of the day, really. It just kind of one melds into another. I don't know what day it is unless I look at my phone and I see what day of the week it is.
Illinois' COVID-19 Nerve Center is in Pritzker's 15th floor office suite in the James R. Thompson Center in downtown Chicago. And for the governor and a handful of senior aides, the days there start early and end late, most of them 12 to 16 hours long. Pritzker spends his day talking with his staff and with other governors. A couple of days a week, he's on the phone with the White House. It's been like this for 39 straight days, through an election, on weekends, even on Easter Sunday.
From pretty much the moment I wake up and I look at my inbox and read the newspaper to the moment after I watch the news at night, when after I get home, you know, I'm thinking nonstop about this, and it's hard. If you ask my staff, they'll tell you the same thing.
That downtown coronavirus nerve center is where Pritzker made the decision to close schools, bars, and restaurants, and where he issued Illinois' stay-at-home order nearly a month ago. It's where he's been scrambling to find protective gear for healthcare workers and scrambling to get a state computer system in order so that hundreds of thousands of people out of work can get unemployment benefits. Crises bring out the best and the worst in public office holders, and this very much could be Pritzker's defining moment. So I wondered how he's been weighing all these tough decisions and how he's coping with the crisis.
We all get the sense of mission here. And we know that, like, every minute, every hour, you know, that we're at this, we have the potential to save people's lives. Frankly, that's a motivator like none other.
But every day at 12:30 comes the meeting he describes as the most depressing part of the day. That's when Pritzker gets the death tally from the previous 24 hours from the state's public health director. People, not data points.
I mean, it's a terrible thing. You know, normally in politics and in government, you know, you're dealing with budgets and you're dealing with, you know, families and, you know, the numbers are important, but not every number is something to do with the potential for fatality. But this meeting that we have every day is really focused on that.
The emotional grind has been real. I asked Pritzker about the most memorable moment of the pandemic. He paused and then talked about these five straight days in early April. 5 days where it looked like things maybe weren't as bad as people thought.
And then the sixth day came and we had a big increase of deaths and a big increase of cases. And that was the day that we reported 73 deaths. And I have to say, it took a little bit of wind out of me. And so I hate to say that's the most memorable day, but at least right at this moment, that's what I would say.
The governor says he's personally reached out to about a dozen families of first responders and healthcare workers who have died from COVID-19. He wishes he could talk with all of the victims' families, but there isn't time in the day.
It's not something you can prepare yourself for. When you become governor, to have to make condolence calls to people who don't know you, but who would value hearing, you know, from the governor about their lost family member.
When I ask Pritzker what has made him angriest during the pandemic, there's no hesitation. It's his dealings with the White House and what he sees as its repeated failures to deliver more testing capacity to Illinois. Criticism like that has caught Trump's attention. Last week, the president called out Pritzker for seeming to be happy with the White House response in private, but deeply critical in public. To hear Pritzker's side, his one direct person-to-person call with Trump was pure frustration.
On the phone with him, I am respectful of the office of the president, but I'm also very direct about what we need and what I hope for and what I expect.
In that mid-March phone call, Pritzker said he urged Trump to invoke a federal law compelling manufacturers like automakers to begin producing more ventilators and personal protective equipment so that states wouldn't be in bidding wars against one another. Pritzker said Trump ignored the idea, then asked what Illinois needed. The governor rattled off more N95 masks, goggles, and the like, and Trump promised to help.
And then an hour later, I got a call from one of his advisors who said, I talked to President Trump and we're going to help you. He said, we're going to do it in Trump time. And he said those words a few times during the conversation, in Trump time. And then he said, we're going to deliver 300,000 N95 masks and 300 ventilators, and we'll get it to you in Trump time. So I thought, wow, that's fantastic. You know, he's not regular time, Trump time.
Pritzker says one day passed, then another, then another. When the shipment finally arrived, Pritzker says the state got its ventilators, but got 300,000 of the wrong kind of masks. I asked the governor for his definition of Trump time.
Well, now I think it means never or very late and not what was promised.
Pritzker lavishes praise on federal agencies that have come to Illinois' assistance, like the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and FEMA. Pritzker grades Trump harshly for his handling of the pandemic. He says the president gets a D from him. But the Democratic governor declined to give himself a grade, saying that's hard to do when people are dying. At the end of his days, when he's at home in Chicago's Gold Coast, Pritzker says the COVID-19 calls keep coming, and there's only a short time to clear his head, even to laugh.
At the very, very end of the day, when I'm just about to go to bed, I flip on something like Tiger King. and I've managed to actually watch all of the episodes of Tiger King, or at least fall asleep during every one of them. That's how I could take my mind off of it.
But the effects of focusing on Joe Exotic and Carol Baskin, the protagonists of the popular Netflix series, are momentary. The pressure of the day is just too great.
It's very hard to turn this off. This is not normal.
And for Pritzker and the people of Illinois huddling in their homes, normalcy won't return until COVID-19 stops killing. This is Dave McKinney.
Up next, a Republican state lawmaker joins us, and there's more of Statewide ahead. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Later, we'll be talking with an Illinois farmer about COVID-19 and some of the changes in the ag industry. That and more still ahead. Up next on Statewide, we welcome Republican State Representative Dan Brady of Bloomington. He has two jobs that are being impacted by COVID-19. He's a lawmaker. He's also a funeral director. And Representative, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sean. Nice to be with you.
We'll get to that other job in just a moment, but let's start talking about state government. I wanted to find out what you're hearing from constituents during this period, because I know a lot of people are out of work. A lot of people are concerned about the future. What are they telling you about?
Well, number one, Sean, is unemployment issues. And those individuals, they contact the office. We were just inundated probably 10 days ago with people that were calling because they could not get on the system. They did get registered, and they made a mistake. They were kicked out, and they had problems. They couldn't get phone calls, returns. They couldn't get back on the system, had questions. And we really, while we fielded a lot of questions early on about essential, what is essential business-wise, and how do we interpret that, it's predominantly been the unemployment side of things.
Well, Governor Pritzker has been criticized by some Republicans over this, that his administration was not prepared to handle that influx, that many people were not able to file for unemployment. I wanted to get your thoughts overall on the job you think the governor is doing during this pandemic. He is holding those daily briefings, of course, trying to communicate with the public. What kind of job do you think he's doing?
Well, I think the governor is doing about as good a job as anyone can do. How do you prepare yourself for something like this? I don't know. I do know that there's always room for improvement. And I would hope one thing occurs after we get back to some sense of normal, that there is what's referred to as a review process to look at where things were, where strengths were, where weaknesses were, and how do we better prepare for the future. When you look at unemployment claims that somewhere around 500,000 that occurred between statewide March 28th, let's say, to about April the 5th, that crashes a system. Now, granted, that system was antiquated, need to be improved, but that was kind of a perfect storm, if you will. And so I think trying to navigate through, the communication has been good, has been improved, but I think that the governor is doing the best he can. Personally called me not too long after I had a meeting with restaurant owners and bar owners, and we discussed some things. So it's one of those things that I think the governor is doing the best that he can, and we've communicated with him and his staff in different ways and have offered advice in different areas.
Well, you talked about getting back to normal. It seems like it's going to be a long time before that happens. It's been weeks since the legislature actually got together and met. Normally, you would be entering the stretch run of the spring session right now. What have you heard about actually reconvening?
To date, I have only heard that the discussion continues about being ready to go back on what would have been Easter break. We know that for the most part now, Easter break is over with. There is been discussion that maybe it would be something that we would have a session that would focus on nothing but immediate emergency budget-related issues and then adjourn. That time frame in which I was hearing things weeks ago, obviously, like the sand in the hourglass, has run out. And so I look to get new information, and I know that the speaker has talked about developing these working groups, but I'd certainly like to get back and address the budget issues that we have and are going to have and that are just pressing and are going to take not only a lot of time, but are going to be extremely complicated.
And this is a state that's already had fiscal problems going back for many years now. We have a large backlog of bills that's still trying to, you know, pay that down as well. Now you have this on top of it. Where do you even start in trying to put a budget together?
Well, I think that you go back to what was some of the most turbulent time in the last couple of years when the state didn't have a budget and operated to the best of our ability without a budget, that impasse period of time. What can we learn from that? One of the things that came out of that was by rank and file members pushing for at least a six-month budget, a bridge budget, if you will. I think that lesson from that is something could be applied in this situation. You know, to think that Illinois was just beginning to, I think, bounce back in a lot of ways. Had anyone told you this scenario was going to unfold, obviously you wouldn't have believed them.
So a six-month budget, you believe it would allow for the state to have a better picture of where revenues are, where other expenditures are later in the fiscal year, and you could make adjustments at that time?
Yes. I don't know how you plan much further out than increments, time increments at a time. Now, obviously, I don't know exactly without doing research what can we do statutorily in that respect and what has to change statutorily. But to think that we can plan for an entire year with the unknown variables of revenue, obviously the spending side, and then you put the equation in of the economy and unemployment in this state, that is not a very good recipe for trying to put together some stable budget.
And of course, there is going to be more spending when it comes to, you know, areas like health care, I would guess. Nobody wants to see funding for schools reduced in any way. Are there some parts of the budget you think should brace for cuts? And I would mention higher education. That's one of the big key employers in your district, certainly. Would Right. that be something that might be on the chopping block a bit more here because of all of these problems?
Well, I don't. I think, and you hear this quite often, everything's on the table. I believe everything is on the table. Do I think there's other places to look for belt tightening in state government? Absolutely. And if anything can come out of this terrible situation, it might be the fact that it's going to force some priorities when it comes to spending and priorities when it comes to cuts. I don't think anyone will be immune from some type of reduction in what their budget looks like. And I think setting our priorities, public safety, public education, and public infrastructure, is going to be hopefully a guiding force for us when we do get back to Springfield.
We're talking with Republican State Representative Dan Brady of Bloomington. I mentioned at the start, Representative, you have another job. You're a funeral director as well. And I wanted to discuss that industry with you because it is also undergoing some changes right now. For those who don't know, can you talk about what is allowed at this time if somebody is trying to plan a funeral?
Well, there are guidelines that have been put out by the Department of Public Health, the National Funeral Directors Association, and the Illinois Funeral Directors Association. In fact, there was a group of individuals that offered in back around March 28th advice to the administration, to Governor Pritzker's administration, on how to look at the anticipated deaths and the numbers and how to deal with those deaths due to the virus. In respects to the funerals side of things, it's changed the industry completely. First off, you are in a situation now where you find yourself that the churches, if a family has a church affiliation or church family, that the churches aren't open. And so churches are not, church funerals, more traditional type funerals, are not occurring. What you see largely right now in obituaries that are placed in print media is the fact that there would be a celebration of life or some memorial service at a future date. So that has changed the planning part of things. When you then have a individual who has died from the virus, their family has to be quarantined. And so therefore, you're not sitting across a conference table making funeral arrangements. You're doing something either by phone or by video conference. That has changed the industry. Providing some type of video conferencing for what may be a brief graveside service or a brief service at the funeral home with 10 people or less is become something that our firm has not only explored but is producing. What we have signs throughout our funeral homes that indicate that direct eye contact, loving words, and a warm smile are as meaningful to the family as a traditional handshake or hug. And so the social distancing is practiced. And the real sad part of things is those that have the virus and succumb to the virus, die from the virus, they're doing it for the most part alone and away from their family.
Yeah, and that has to be one of the more sad things, somebody passing away and the family's not able to gather, celebrate their life. Are people putting off memorial services at least till a later time? Are you seeing more of that?
Yes. For instance, former Representative Gordon Ropp, who died yesterday from my district here, Gordon's family had chosen for a burial, a traditional burial, with just their immediate family to practice the social distancing, but are looking for a celebration of the former representative's life in the future. And that is very common among families across the state of Illinois, and I would assume across the country, that are making those decisions. And they're making those decisions, quite frankly, because that's about one of the few options that remain to try and provide their safety and comfort, yet honoring and memorializing their loved one.
I know it comes down to individuals and what decision they want to make, but what kind of guidance are you giving people when they say, you know, I'm not sure what to do right now because of all these, you know, changes that are in place? You know, what are you telling them?
Well, the decisions have been made and policies, if you will, that have been implemented has been made on behalf of those, the living, for their safety and for their, hopefully, peace of mind and forethought. And I think most of the families that I've dealt with during their difficult time of the death of a loved one understand that. And many of the families are comfortable with that, not their first choice. But it's affected everything. Even in our area, if you have a graveside service, honors, taps for a deceased veteran is not being done because the guard can't come out and provide that. And so there's talk of maybe doing something down the road when we get back to some sense of normal, of a community service, honoring all those who perished in our area during the virus and who served their country. And so those are the type of things we look forward to from the standpoint of trying to help the families in the future. But I think, again, most of the families understand, even in the most difficult time of death, be prepared for the fact that there will be some things that are completely out of your control. And a lot of those relate to the planning of what you maybe wanted to do for your loved one when it comes to funeral arrangements that you simply can't do at this point in time.
Dan Brady is a Republican state representative from Bloomington. He's also a funeral director. And Representative, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Sean.
Illinoisans experiencing mental illness have had to face a new world in the pandemic. Most, except for those in residential or emergency situations, have had to make the choice between not having therapy or having to do it by phone or computer screen. Maureen McKinney looked into how that transition is working.
Mark Hicks has been a therapist since the 1970s. Once upon a time, it would have been inconceivable that he would work with his clients via a computer screen. But then came the pandemic and the stay-at-home order. Though he's 82 and semi-retired, the Chicagoan has tried to keep up with technology. So when the need came to use the telehealth platform, he did.
Initially, the thing that was the big topic of any session we were having was about the pandemic. But over time, that's gradually taken a backseat. It's still there, but then the other issues like people's depression and anxiety and mixed moods kinds of things have come back to the front.
Throughout the state, people who struggle with mental health issues have had to deal with a new normal. In fact, the leader of the Community Behavioral Health Association of Illinois estimates that a few weeks ago, only about 5 to 10% of the services were provided by phone or computer. The remainder were in person. Since the spread of COVID-19, the opposite is true. Andy Wade is with the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Illinois. He says there's reason to believe video therapy works.
This is a time where there's a lot of anxiety and a lot of fear and a lot of unknown in the world. And it's okay to ask for help, and it's okay to get help however you can get it. It's especially important if there isn't a resource nearby. You would be surprised how useful it can be to talk to somebody on a video screen.
The change has come at a rapid fire pace, said Patrick Phelan, who leads Cinesippi Centers in northwestern Illinois.
We were right about the middle of March. Over that weekend, things escalated quite a bit. And by the following Monday, we were really changing the way that we do absolutely everything.
Ann Tyree is with Centerstone, a national healthcare provider that offers multiple services to 5 Southern Illinois counties.
With the outbreak and the pandemic and the stay-at-home order, the array of services and the amount of contact that we've been able to offer has been more limited to protect the client as well as our staff. And I think that's difficult and challenging for people who have a serious mental illness who already tend to isolate. And when they're ill, this is certainly not helping.
It's not always easy to switch to phone or computer to communicate. Sometimes there's no way to avoid human contact. There are residential patients or those who must be given medications like injections or those who are in a crisis state. Many of the clients are lower income and lack available minutes on their phone. So telehealth is not an option, Tyree says. Others lack access to high-speed internet, which means that they can't use the telehealth platform that Centerstone offers. Katie Mitchell is a Byron resident and Cinesippi Center's social worker who treats clients of all ages. She says she likes to think of teletherapy as an opportunity rather than a barrier.
Especially for a lot of my kid clients and adolescent clients, have a different type of relationship with them where I could see them in their home and create a very safe and secure space for them that we didn't have access in the office.
But she realizes what is lost in the translation.
Really what we know in our profession is that connection, whether it's a handshake, eye contact, touch on the shoulder, that really provides, you know, increased dopamine, and we need connection as humans.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
Statewideshow.com, that's our website. You can find our episodes there. We have more ahead. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Governor J.B. Pritzker says summer event organizers should start thinking about canceling. That's left some to wonder about the biggest summer events the state of Illinois puts on, the two state fairs. Every year, crowds of people flood fairgrounds in Springfield and DuQuoin. Pritzker says he knows a decision has to be made soon. He says contracts have to be signed and organizers need time to prepare.
I'm also just going to listen to the experts and make sure that we do the right thing so that we don't spread this COVID-19 and that we don't have a spike in hospitalizations and ultimately in people passing away.
Springfield's Mayor Jim Langfelder says the state should take a wait-and-see approach.
There's certain things that you would have to cancel, like grandstand acts, things of that nature. So there will be a point in time where you'll have to kind of make a more firm decision on what that would look like if it's allowed to go forward.
Langfelder says Springfield's economy would suffer if the fair was canceled, but says he understands restrictions are needed to respond to the pandemic. The Illinois Department of Agriculture says it's working closely with the Illinois Department of Public Health to determine the best course forward for the 2020 state fairs. A giant of Illinois agriculture has died. Former state representative and state ag director and longtime 4-H booster Gordon Ropp was 87 years old. Charlie Schlinker tells us more.
Gordon Ropp never knew a stranger. Almost everyone talked with for this story said those words. State Representative Keith Summer of Morton is one.
Everyone, when they think of Gordy Ropp, think of an energetic individual with an ever-present smile and his warm personality and his laughter and his storytelling. I think everyone who ever came across Gordy Ropp will always remember him for that.
Ropp was raised on his parents' dairy farm in Normal Township and milked cows by hand starting at age 6. His father bought a milking machine a few years after that. He never left agriculture, even when he became state representative for 14 years in the 80s and early 90s. Keith Summer says Ropp was one of the few farmers in the General Assembly. Those representatives sat together in the front row in the House and called it Farmer's Row. State Representative Dan Brady of Normal says Ropp's approachable style has inflected his own retail politics approach to government service.
You think about a guy who knew everybody, and if he hadn't met you by the time he was in a room, he would have met you before he leaves and visit with you and make you feel good about yourself. He had that type of personality.
Ropp was known for building bridges instead of burning them, something that could seem quaint today, according to Bill Kemp, the librarian at the McLean County Museum of History.
He would always lead the legislature, the House of Representatives, in the Pledge of Allegiance to begin a session. That was Gordon in many ways. In this age of hyper-partisanship, we really need people like him that could reach across the aisle.
Ropp lost his House seat in 1992 in the Republican primary to Bill Brady, who is now Senate Minority Leader. It was famously close, a 7-vote margin after a laborious 3-month recount fight. His House service was not even Ropp's first act. He was State Agriculture Director from 1970 to 1974 under then-Governor Richard Ogilvie. And Bill Kemp says Ropp worked to eradicate the disease of hog cholera.
He led the charge as Secretary of Agriculture for the state to really renew its attention in addressing kind of this pernicious disease that was, and still does to some extent, impact hogs.
Ropp also spent more than 60 years as the leader of the Silverleaf 4-H Club in McLean County. Mike O'Grady is a fellow 4-H leader and oftentimes McLean County Fair Livestock Superintendent.
What a giver. What he gave back to the community and its youth. His efforts in 4-H, even in his last years, was so enthusiastic with the kids. I mean, they went to him as a leader.
Ropp spent decades as a judge and many other roles in the fair. O'Grady says Ropp epitomized the 4-H tradition.
You never step down. We just reassign jobs. So I think that's a true statement.
Even as Ropp became sick, he remained involved. Don Meyer is a retired McLean County Extension Director and longtime 4-H Fair leader.
He's always there when you called on Gordy to help. He was there to help. And I think even as late as last year at the county fair. So just an amazing bundle of energy.
Longtime friend and former Illinois Farm Bureau official Danny Leifel says Ropp was as dedicated to the public as anybody could be.
Charitable auctioneer at virtually every organization he belonged to, and he always started off with a joke, usually very corny. He never told an off-color joke, but boy, was it cornball.
Liefel says Rapp was nominated for an honor in the Scottish Rite Masonic Order and asked Liefel to do the introduction at the presentation, and then Rapp forgot to come to the meeting. Liefel said Rapp was more about the work than the awards. Representative Dan Brady says Rapp never put on airs or considered himself above anyone else.
He was as common as they come, as personal as they come, and he was passionate about everything that he did.
Brady says he learned quite a bit from Gordon Rapp, that if you treat people the way you want them to treat you, it will take you a long way in government. Brady says Rapp simply loved people, and all else flows from that. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
The new coronavirus pandemic has impacted nearly every sector of Illinois' economy, and the state's farms, large and small, have begun to feel the pinch themselves. As producers work to put food on grocery store shelves, those same people have had to change aspects of the way they conduct day-to-day activities. Our reporter Sam Dunklaw talked with Krista Swanson. She farms with her family in Knox County. She's also a seed dealer and researches agriculture economics and policy at the University of Illinois. She offered a few insights on what it's like to be farming during a pandemic.
Krista, we're just about to get into the spring planting season. Spring is now, of course, upon us. So how has that activity been affected by this, you know, big virus pandemic?
Yeah. This isn't only a critical time across the nation, but it's also a really critical time of year on our farms because we are right at the beginning of planting season here in Illinois, and that means that there's a lot happening on the farms. We have to do more interacting than normal, I guess, to get the inputs that we need. For example, seed and fertilizer, or maybe finishing your taxes. There's a lot of things that are happening right now and over the past month since, you know, the effects of the virus have come into play on how we do things. And so we're having to figure out how to change those interactions. Like, for example, in addition to farming, we are also a seed supplier of agricultural seed like corn and soybean seed to other farmers as well. And so one thing that has changed is, you know, agribusinesses like the seed company that we work with have waived. Normally when we deliver the seed, we would need to get a signature from the farmer who's getting that seed, and that requirement's been waived for this year. So I think that there's been some simple changes like that that have just changed the way that some of these interactions normally happen, and have allowed people to be able to still meet the social distancing requirements while still getting the things done that we need to keep our farms running and make sure that we can make it through the planting season.
You know, I'm curious. I know the weather has been going back and forth on top of the virus pandemic. Have you been able to get into your fields to plant? Have you heard from others? Have they been able to do the same? Or have there been delays, you know, what with this virus going around?
Yeah, there's definitely been some planting that's happened. We actually planted a little bit earlier this week, and I know some other farms have as well. It's still a little bit early to be planting, but even if you're not planting yet, there's still a lot of other field work that might need to be done to finish preparing your fields for planting. Farmers are always used to dealing with weather, and this year we have the challenge of when are we going to get that optimal window, you know, with the weather, and what might be happening with the virus at that time. You know, how might over the coming couple weeks where we're in that optimal period for planting, how, you know, what impact is the virus going to have on our day-to-day lives and those interactions that we can have or need to be having to get the inputs we need to plant our crops.
In your view, when something, you know, unprecedented like this comes along, does it impact smaller farms more, or, you know, does it really take a larger toll on the bigger farming operations like co-ops?
Well, I really think that this situation is going to cause challenges for, you know, really farms of all sizes. I mean, larger farms sometimes have the benefit of economies of scale when it comes to the expense end, but you know, they're still subject to the price in the marketplace that, you know, the same a farm selling the same product of, or the same agricultural good of any size is going to face. So I really think that this situation with the just uncertainty in the marketplace and, you know, markets always tend to have the expectation for, at this point in the growing season, expectations for big crops in 2020. And so if prices, the combination of those things keeps prices at the points where they are now, it's going to cause cash flow challenges. And probably make it difficult to break even on farms of all sizes.
Are you concerned about the long-term impacts on what this is going to do to agriculture? Or at this point, is it really more about things like, you know, the weather?
It's really a combination. I think when we think about what are our concerns for this year on the farm, it's a combination of, you know, weather, trade, a lot of those things that, you know, that we normally have impacting the prices that we can get for our agricultural goods that we're producing. And then on top of that, we also have the concerns of what is the impact of this virus going to be on our economy. I mean, even if and hopefully, you know, by the beginning of the summer, we see the pressures of the virus on from a health perspective reducing or, you know, becoming lower than what they are right now. But then because this is such an unprecedented situation in modern times, it's hard to predict how long that might continue and what that might mean in turn for prices of our agricultural goods. I think as we think about the longer term, there are, in my opinion, some potential positives. There are some agricultural products that people have flocked to, like dairy products and meat products like beef and pork. Those have been in high demand in this time. And if you look back over the last several years, you know, demand for milk, for example, in the U.S. has been decreasing. So is it possible that we might see a resurgence in demand for that as the economy improves, or demand for our meat products? You know, I don't have the answers to that, but, you know, maybe in the long term this could be a beneficial thing as we come out of this.
Last thing for you, Krista. Farmers, I mean, I think it's fair to say, are used to dealing with the unpredictable. But when it comes to something like this, I mean, is it different?
Farmers are used to dealing with unpredictable situations. You know, our production is literally subject to the mercy of the environment, and we had our issues in dealing with that last year in 2019. And you know, the pandemic is something different than what we've seen before, but it's another challenge that we have to learn how to react to. There's changes that have to be made on our farms and the way we do things on the day-to-day on the farms. I think it's important to remember that, you know, no person or industry is immune to the effects of this pandemic, and I don't just mean contracting the virus. The situation is affecting every one of us in some way, although it's impacting everyone in different ways. So I think that's just really important to remember and, you know, be grateful for all those who are working to ensure our needs are met, whether that's from the food level or to other necessities, to the healthcare workers and everything else in between.
That's Knox County farmer Krista Swanson. She spoke with our reporter, Sam Dunklaw. And that does it for this episode of Statewide. Remember, we're never far away. If you missed any of this week's show or past programs, you can find them at statewideshow.com. We're also on Facebook at Statewide Show. Feel free to drop us a line. Let us know you're tuned in. hope you stay safe and join us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.